Hi, this is Yo, and welcome to Raw Talk, a very special presentation of Raw Talk, as tonight we air for you the God Delusion Debate. It's a debate about the existence of God. I think you'll find it thought-provoking, challenging, and absolutely fascinating, just as I did. So stick around and enjoy this special presentation of the God Delusion Debate.
Good evening. I'm Larry Taunton, Executive Director of Fixed Point Foundation, the sponsor of this event. We welcome you to the University of Alabama at Birmingham, Alice Stevens Center, and we also welcome those who are listening around the world. Tonight's debate features two of the great minds currently writing and speaking on this issue, Professor Richard Dawkins and Dr. John Lennox. I will not waste time now giving you their biographies, as you will find them in your program, but it has been my pleasure to get to know both of these men. We have brought you here this evening under rather false pretenses. There's actually not a debate this evening. Richard Dawkins wanted to come to the Bible Belt to announce his conversion. to the Christian faith. Perhaps I'm mistaken. Incidentally, Richard is representing the atheistic position in this debate, if you didn't know that, and Dr. John Lennox, the Christian one. There's something that I would like to say about the debate itself. We have thought that much of the discussion on this issue hasn't been particularly helpful, as it's frequently framed as science versus religion. What we are seeking to do this evening is to narrow the discussion just a bit, and hence the name of this debate, the God Delusion Debate. So this debate will feature and will focus on the book, The God Delusion, and Richard's assertions therein over and against the Christian faith. A word about Fixed Point Foundation. We are a Christian organization, and unashamedly so, but we also seek thoughtful civil discussion on meaningful issues, and questions regarding eternity we think are meaningful indeed. We ask that you extend every courtesy to these men, whether you agree with them or not. Undoubtedly, there will be much said this evening that you will take issue with. Nonetheless, we hope you will extend to them a southern welcome. We're also pleased to have with us tonight, serving as our moderator, Judge Bill Pryor. Many of you will recall that he was the Attorney General for the state of Alabama and is now a federal judge. Bill, thank you very much. We ask also that you turn off your cell phones and join me in greeting these men and turning it over to Bill Pryor.
Thank you, Larry. Good evening. Welcome to the debate. You all know the theme, and Larry has introduced it, the God Delusion versus Christianity. There will be a structure to our debate this evening. We will begin with opening autobiographical statements from each of our debaters, beginning with Professor Dawkins and then turning to Dr. Lennox. When I ask that each of them provide those statements, I will ask them to tell us something about themselves, each of them, and something about the book, The God Delusion. We will then turn to the six major theses of Professor Dawkins' book, The God Delusion. Now, obviously, it's a long book. We can't cover everything in it, but we have selected what we think are the six major themes. And to introduce each of those themes, I will read some excerpts from Professor Dawkins' book and then give him an opportunity to elaborate, and then Dr. Lennox an opportunity to respond. Each of those exchanges should be about 5 minutes per side. And then what is not reflected in your program is that each of our debaters will finish the program with final statements, with concluding remarks. We will start that with Dr. Lennox, and then we will turn to Professor Dawkins. So, Professor Dawkins, tonight you will have both the first and the last word, I suppose, in the interest of Christian charity. Professor Dawkins, could you begin our discussion with an autobiographical statement? Tell us something about yourself and about the book.
I was born in Africa. I'm a child of what was in those days the British Empire, descended from a long line of khaki shorts-wearing, hairy-kneed, brown-shoed colonial officers. I had every opportunity to become a naturalist because Africa, as you know, is a wonderful place to be a naturalist. Unfortunately, that's not the way it was. I never was much of a naturalist, much to my father's disappointment, I suspect. He was a very good is a very good naturalist. I suppose that's a preamble to saying that my interest in the science of biology, which is what I specialize in, came more from an interest in fundamental questions than from a love of watching birds or insects or pressing flowers. I wanted to know why we're all here. What is the meaning of life? Why does the universe exist? Why does life exist? That's what drew me to science. My parents left Africa when I was about 8, and I came with them. I was sent to boarding school in England. I suppose part of the point of this autobiographical note is to give a kind of religious background, since we are talking about religion tonight. I had a harmless Anglican upbringing. I could never claim that I had religion thrust down my throat in the way it might have been had I been brought up in a more militant faith. Anglicanism, as you know, is a very civilized version of Christianity. No bells and smells, and no creationist lunacy. I was confirmed into the Church of England, and at the time I sincerely believed it. I had a brief period of doubt at the age of about 9 before, about 3 years before my confirmation. This doubt was caused by the realization that there are lots of different religions in the world, and I recognized that it was an accident of my birth that I happened to have been born into the Christian faith, and I recognized instantly that had I been born in, say, Afghanistan or born in India, I would have believed very different things. And that quite rightly shook my faith in the particular religion that I'd been brought up in. Weirdly, and I now don't understand why, I seem to have lost those doubts when I was about 13, and I was confirmed into the Church of England. I went to Oxford after having lost my faith for good at the age of about 15 or 16. That was because I discovered Darwinism. I recognized that there was no good reason to believe in any kind of supernatural creator. And my final vestige, last vestige of religious faith disappeared when I finally understood the Darwinian explanation for life. I went to Oxford. I got a doctorate at Oxford eventually. I went to the University of California at Berkeley as a very young assistant professor, teaching in those days animal behavior. I then went back to Oxford after about 2 years at Berkeley and continued my career as a student of animal behavior. About 1972, there was a general strike in Britain, and there was no electric power. I couldn't do my research, and so I thought I would write a book. And I started to write a book, which eventually became my first book, The Selfish Gene. However, unfortunately, the electric power came on again, and so I shelved the first two chapters of the book that I'd already written, put them in a drawer, and forgot about them, until about 3 years later in 1975, when I got a sabbatical leave and resumed writing The Selfish Gene. Since then, I've written about 8 more books, Extended Phenotype, The Blind Watchmaker, River Out of Eden, Climbing Mount Improbable, Unweaving the Rainbow, A Devil's Chaplain, The Ancestor's Tale, and most recently, The God Delusion, which is the subject of tonight's debate. I regard it as an enormous privilege to be alive and I regard it as a privilege to be alive, especially at the end of the 20th century, beginning of the 21st century, a privilege to be a scientist, and therefore to be in a position to understand something of the mystery of existence, why we exist. I think that religious explanations, although they may have been satisfying for many centuries, are now superseded and outdated. I think, moreover, that they're petty and parochial, and that the understanding that we can get from science of all those deep questions that religion once aspired to explain are now better, more grandly, in a more beautiful and elegant fashion explained by science.
Dr. Lennox.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for inviting me. I'm delighted to be here. Each one of us has a biography and a worldview, our set of answers to the big questions that life throws at us. And so a little about my biography. I'm married to Sally. We have 3 children and 4 grandchildren. I work now in the University of Oxford as a mathematician and as a philosopher of science. I was born in the middle of the last century in a country with a tragic reputation for sectarian violence, Northern Ireland. My parents were Christian, but they were not sectarian. In the book, The God Delusion, Richard, you say that religion teaches us that it is a virtue to be satisfied with not understanding. Well, whatever other religion this may apply to, it certainly did not apply to the Christianity my parents taught me from the Bible. They encouraged me to be intellectually inquisitive because they were like that themselves. Not in spite of their Christian faith, but because of it. And I owe them an immense debt for setting me free to read everything from Marx and Russell to C.S. Lewis, and developed in those days an interest in the big questions of life. I was very fortunate to get the chance to leave Ireland and go to Cambridge, where I could indulge my passion for mathematics and for science in general. And Cambridge not only gave me the opportunity to develop those intellectual pursuits, but it gave me the opportunity to meet many people of other worldviews who did not share my background and my convictions. As a result, I developed a considerable interest in atheism, an interest which led me subsequently as an Alexander von Humboldt Fellow to study in Germany and then travel very frequently to Eastern Europe during the period of the Cold War. After the fall of communism, I went very often to the academies of science and universities in Russia to discuss and reason about these things and to see at first hand the effect of systematic exposure to atheist indoctrination over the preceding 70 years. And so I too am very privileged to live at this time and to be involved in the public discussion of these issues. Now, reading Richard's book, I found absolutely fascinating because it strikes me as an impassioned crusade to warn his fellow human beings of the slavery, the oppression, and the mental and possibly physical tortures imposed on them by religion. And I actually feel a lot of sympathy for you on this particular point because I myself am totally opposed to any religion that seeks to impose itself by force, or that takes advantage of or abuses people in any way. You cannot impose truth by force. And both of us, I think, hold that religion should be debated in a rational way as anything else. I share his passion for truth, neither of us, mercifully, as a postmodern relativist. But as a passionate atheist, Richard is committed to the idea that God is a delusion. For him, ultimate reality, I take it, consists of the impersonal matter and energy of the universe. I believe the exact opposite. God, far from being a delusion, is real. Ultimate reality is a personal, eternal, and supernatural God who has revealed himself in the universe, in his word, the Bible, and supremely in Jesus Christ, his Son, who is Lord and God incarnate. Now, I'm very aware that this puts me, according to Richard's book, firmly in the category of those who sit fluttering among the dovecotes of the deluded, sucking my religious dummy, or pacifier, as you call it in Alabama. You suggest that religion builds a firewall in the mind against scientific truth. Well, that might be tragically the case with some religions, but it's not so with biblical Christianity. Indeed, the reason, ladies and gentlemen, that I'm passionate about truth is that God is the God of all truth. One of the most famous statements that Jesus ever made was, "I am the truth." An astonishing assertion that, as C.S. Lewis pointed out long ago, is either megalomaniac, pathologically mistaken, or valid, since he is claiming not merely to say true things, although that is so, but claiming to be ultimate truth itself, the ultimate truth behind everything from the Andromeda Nebula to human life, conscience, and mind. Please note that what divides us is not science. We're both committed to it. What divides us is our worldviews, his atheistic, mine theistic, and Christian. Now, his book presents to us a grim world. It is a no-holds-barred attempt to deliver people from the dragon of religion so that they can lead a life of uninhibited self-fulfillment, unencumbered with the background threat of an imaginary God. And he says it looks bleak and cold, especially from the security blanket of religious ignorance. But, ladies and gentlemen, we need to take it seriously. If that's the way it is, then that's the way it is, and we need to face it. But we need to discuss it seriously and look at the evidence. Neither of us wishes to base his life on a delusion. But which is the delusion? Atheism or Christianity? That is for each of us to decide on the basis of the evidence, of course.
Thank you. The first thesis of Professor Dawkins' book, and each of these that's reflected in your program, is a summary. It's not a direct quotation, but the summary is, faith is blind, science is evidence-based. I have one excerpt at the top of page 126 to illustrate your argument, Professor Dawkins. One of the truly bad effects of religion is that it teaches us that it is a virtue to be satisfied with not understanding. Could you please elaborate?
Science uses evidence to discover the truth about the universe. It's been getting better at it over the centuries in the teeth of opposition from religion, although it has to be admitted that, of course, science grew out of a religious tradition. Religion, as the quotation that Judge Pryor read out, teaches us to be satisfied with, was it lack of evidence or lack of...
With not understanding.
With not understanding. I think that when you consider the beauty of the world and you wonder how it came to be what it is, you are naturally overwhelmed with a feeling of awe, a feeling of admiration, and you almost feel a desire to worship something. I feel this. I recognize that other scientists such as Carl Sagan feel this. Einstein felt it. We all of us share a kind of religious reverence for the beauties of the universe, for the complexity of life, for the sheer magnitude of the cosmos, the sheer magnitude of geological time. And it's tempting to translate that feeling of awe and worship into a desire to worship some particular thing, a person, an agent. You want to attribute it to a maker, to a creator. What science has now achieved is an emancipation from that impulse to attribute these things to a creator. And it's a major emancipation, because humans have an almost overwhelming desire to think that they've explained something by attributing it to a maker. We're so used to explaining things in our own world, like these television cameras, like the lights, like everything that we make, the clothes we wear, the chairs we sit on, everything we see around us is a manufactured object. And so it's so tempting to believe that that has been made, that living things, or that the stars or mountains or rivers have all been made by something. It was a supreme achievement of the human intellect to realize that there is a better explanation for these things, that these things can come about by purely natural causes. When science began, the aim to achieve it was there, but we didn't know enough. Nowadays, at the end of the 20th century, beginning of the 21st century, we still don't know everything, but we've achieved an enormous amount in the way of understanding. We now understand essentially how life came into being. We know that we are all cousins of all animals and plants. We know that we're descended from a common ancestor, which might have been something like bacteria. We know the process by which that came about. We don't know the details, but we understand essentially how it came about. There are still gaps in our understanding. We don't understand how the cosmos came into existence in the first place, but we're working on that. The scientific enterprise is an active seeking out of gaps in our knowledge, seeking out of ignorance, so that we can work to plug that ignorance. But religion teaches us to be satisfied with not really understanding. Every one of these difficult questions that comes up, science says, right, let's roll up our sleeves and work on it. Religion says, oh, God did it. We don't need to work on it. God did it. It's as simple as that. We have no thrusting force pushing us on to try to understand. Religion stultifies the impulse to understand, because religion provides a facile, easy, apparent explanation, although, as we'll see later in the evening, it isn't really an explanation, and it prevents the further work on the problem.
Okay. Thank you. Dr. Lennox?
There are two issues here. Faith is blind, science is evidence-based. I do not agree with the first one, but I very much agree with the second one. Some faith is blind. And blind faith can be very dangerous, especially if it's coupled with a blind obedience to an evil authority. And that, ladies and gentlemen, I would like to emphasize, is true whether the blind faith is that of religious or secular people. But not all faith is blind faith, because faith itself carries with it the ideas of belief, trust, commitment, and is therefore only as robust as the evidence for it. Faith in the flying spaghetti monster, much beloved of Richard Dawkins, a delightful idea, is blind because there's no evidence for the flying spaghetti monster. But faith in relativity theory is not blind because there is evidence supporting it. I can't speak authoritatively for other religions, but faith in the Christian sense is not blind. And indeed, I do not know a serious Christian who thinks it is. Indeed, as I read it, blind faith in idols and figments of the human imagination, in other words, delusional gods, is roundly condemned in the Bible. My faith in God and Christ as the Son of God is no delusion. It is rational and evidence-based. Part of the evidence is objective. Some of it comes from science. Some comes from history. And some is subjective, coming from experience. Now, of course, we do not speak of proof. You only get proof in the strict sense in my own field of mathematics. But in every other field, including science, we can't speak of proof. We can speak of evidence, of pointers, of being convinced beyond reasonable doubt. I think it's important in this context to emphasize that science is limited, because there seems to me a creeping danger of equating science with rationality. But what is beyond science is not necessarily irrational. Science cannot tell us, for instance, whether a poem, a work of literature, or a work of art or music is good or beautiful. Science can tell us that if you put strychnine into your grandmother's tea, it will kill her. But science cannot tell you whether it's morally right to do so. And the Nobel Prize winner, Sir Peter Medawar, who's quite a hero, I think, for both of us, has pointed out that you can easily see the limits of science because it cannot answer the elementary questions of a child. Who am I? What is the purpose of my existence? Where am I going? Now, Richard has just contrasted science and religion, religion being content with not understanding, whereas science is unraveling the understanding of the universe. And I understand and feel the force of that objection very strongly, because sometimes Christians, I admit, have been guilty of a lazy God of the gaps kind of solution. I can't understand it, therefore God did it. And of course God disappears as the gaps close. But I'd like to point out that there are two kinds of gap, ladies and gentlemen. There are gaps that science closes, and I call those the bad gaps. But there are also gaps that science opens, and we may come to some of those later. But as for the idea itself, Richard referred to the very important fact that science, modern science as we know it, exploded in the 16th and 17th centuries, and it arose out of a theistic background. And many philosophers of science have studied this and come to the conclusion that's now called Whitehead's thesis, that human beings became scientific because they expected law in nature, and they expected law in nature because they believed in a lawgiver. I think that is profoundly important, because it means, far from religion hindering science, it was the driving force behind the rise of science in the first place. And when Isaac Newton, for example, discovered his law of gravity and wrote down the equations of motion, he didn't say, marvelous, I now understand it, I've got a mechanism, therefore I don't need God. In fact, it was the exact opposite. It was because he understood the complexity and sophistication of the mathematical description of the universe that his praise for God was increased. And I would like to suggest, Richard, that somewhere down in this you're making a category mistake, because you're confusing mechanism with agency. We have a mechanism, it does X, Y, and Z, therefore there's no need for an agent. I would suggest that the sophistication of the mechanism, and science rejoices in finding such mechanisms, is evidence for the sheer wonder of the creative genius of God.
Our next thesis is that science supports atheism, not Christianity. And on this thesis, Professor Dawkins, I would like to read two excerpts from your book. The first is on page 67. You are quoting your colleague, the Chicago geneticist Jerry Coyne, with approval, and he writes, "To scientists like Dawkins and E.O. Wilson, the celebrated Harvard biologist, the real war is between rationalism and superstition. Science is but one form of rationalism, while religion is the most common form of superstition." Several pages earlier, on page 59, you write, "Noma," which is the idea that religion and science do not overlap, non-overlapping magisteria, is popular only because there is no evidence to favor the God hypothesis. Would you care to elaborate?
Yes. First, I'd like to respond a little bit to what John said on the previous occasion. I feel happier if we could have a bit more of a dialogue rather than this When you say faith is rational and evidence-based, I mean, if that were true, it wouldn't need to be faith, would it? I mean, if there were evidence for it, why would you need to call it faith? You'd say just evidence. And when you said that faith in relativity, in Einstein's theory of relativity, is evidence-based, that, of course, it is. But the evidence is all important. I mean, Einstein's predictions fit in with observed fact and with a whole body of theory, whereas we only need to use the word faith when there isn't any evidence.
I presume you've got faith in your wife. Is there any evidence for that?
Yes, which
plenty. You base it? Yes,
plenty of evidence. Let's generalize it. Never mind about my wife. Let's generalize.
It's the same with mine, Richard. It's the same with mine.
Let's say that in general, how do we know that somebody loves us? Okay?
Yes.
You can use a word faith for that if you like, but it's not the right use of the word.
Because, oh, it is.
Because you know your wife loves you because of all sorts of little signs, little catches in the voice, little looks in the eye. That's the evidence that it is.
Yes,
that's evidence.
Right.
That's perfectly good evidence. That's not faith.
Yes, it is.
Well, okay, then we're coming down to pure semantics.
I think you've been influenced too much by Kant, you see.
Not explicitly, I have to say.
Let's
go on. Which of these statements are we now on?
We're on the second.
Looking for an opening. Right.
It didn't seem to have much connection with the quotes from the God delusion that you read.
It actually works well with the first.
Okay, it does. You read a quote from Jerry Coyne about the real war being between supernaturalism and naturalism. The context of that quote was the turf wars, in a sense, in American education between creationism and evolution. And within that context, I have been accused of letting the side down because, as you know, there's a problem with American education that some nutcases are trying to introduce creationism into American schools, which is obviously very bad for science. And my scientific colleagues are deeply worried by this and are trying to fight it, and all power to them. They complain that I am not helping matters, that I'm in a sense rocking the boat by saying quite openly that it is my understanding of evolution that has led me to atheism. And they point out again quite rightly that if I were called up to in a court of law testifying in favour of evolution and against the teaching of creationism, and the lawyer said, "Mr. Dawkins, is it true that evolution has led you to atheism?" I should have to say yes. Whereupon he would turn to the jury and say, "My case rests." It doesn't do the cause of science any good to unite evolution with atheism. That was the context of Jerry Coyne's remark. Coyne was saying, okay, if you're concerned only with the narrow political battle of saving American science in the schools, then you should button your lip and stop talking about atheism. If, on the other hand, you think, as Coyne does, that the real war is between supernaturalism and naturalism, then you would say, well, the battle over evolution and creationism is only a skirmish. The real war is over something rather more profound. That was the context of that. Noma was the second quotation that you read. That's non-overlapping magisteria. The late Stephen Gould argued that there was no real battle between science and religion because they were about non-overlapping magisteria, different things, ships that pass in the night, no contact between them. They're about totally different things. I don't think that for a moment. I think that religion really is, in a sense, about science. I think that religious claims about the universe are scientific claims. I suspect that John may agree with me about this. Claims about the universe are scientific claims. A universe with a God would be a very different kind of universe from a universe without a God. Scientific methods are the appropriate methods, or at least the scientific way of thinking is an appropriate way of thinking for deciding whether we live in this kind of universe with a God or that kind of universe without a God. It becomes even more glaring where you talk about miracles, which, I mean, however much sophisticated theologians may profess their non-belief in miracles, the plain fact is that the ordinary person in the pew, the ordinary unsophisticated churchgoer, believes deeply in miracles, and it's largely miracles that persuade that person into the church in the first place. If there are miracles, they are to be judged as by scientific means. If there was a virgin birth, if somebody was raised from the dead, these are strictly scientific claims. They may be difficult to verify, but as I've said in the book, The God Delusion, if you could imagine, hypothetically, that DNA evidence could be discovered showing that Jesus never had a father, that Jesus was born of a virgin, then can you imagine any theologian saying, oh, no, not relevant, separate magisteria, science has no bearing on this case? Of course they wouldn't. Science has every bearing on this case. That's what I have to say about MoMA, and I think I probably run out of my 5 minutes.
Thank you, Professor Dawkins.
Well, I agree with you very much on the NOMA issue, Richard, that science and religion, keeping them separate. Actually, if you read the small print on NOMA, it rather disconcerts you because it says that science deals with reality and religion with everything else. And, of course, I'm not very happy with that. I certainly agree with you that the modes of logical analysis that science has introduced to you are the right ones to deal with many of the central claims of Christianity. I would widen it a bit. It's historical science, of course. We're dealing with events in the past. But Christianity is falsifiable in that technical sense. I would very much support that. Now, the thesis here is that science supports atheism, not Christianity. I think atheism undermines science very seriously. Because if you think of the basic assumption that all of us who are scientists have, that is, we believe in the rational intelligibility of the universe. And it's interesting to me that scientists of the eminence of Eugene Wigner and Albert Einstein use the word faith. They cannot imagine a scientist without this faith. Because, of course, they point out that you've got to believe in the rational intelligibility of the universe before you can do any science at all. Science doesn't give you that. Now, the interesting thing is this. Suppose we now look at that issue against the background of the two worldviews we're discussing tonight, atheism and theism. Atheism tells you, at least Richard tells us in his book, that since human life has been cobbled together by unguided evolution, it's unlikely that our view of the world is accurate. Quite so. And if you are a reductionist, as you must be as a materialist, reducing beliefs to the physics and chemistry of neurological structures, then it raises a very big question, ladies and gentlemen. If in the end my beliefs, my theories, my scientific theories, are the results ultimately of the motions of atoms in my brain produced by an unguided, random, mindless process, why should I believe them? In other words, it's like someone sitting on the branch of a tree cutting off the branch on which they're sitting. And it seems to me that, therefore, atheism actually undercuts the scientific endeavor very seriously. And that, for my mind, is a fatal flaw. An argument that purports to derive rationality from irrationality doesn't even rise, in my opinion, to the dignity of being an intelligible delusion. It is logically incoherent. But theism tells us that the reason science is possible, the reason that I can access the universe, at least in part through my human intelligence, is because the same God who created the universe is ultimately responsible for the human mind in here. So that's the base level. But when we come up a level now and look at science itself, we have the fine-tuning of the universe, the fact that the basic constants of nature have got to be very accurate in order to have a universe just like this one. Now, I know that some people prefer, that's the word that Sir Martin Rees uses, an explanation in terms of a multiverse, which actually doesn't, in my opinion, solve the logical problems. But I'm very interested in the verdict of Arno Penzias, who won the Nobel Prize for discovering the microwave background. And he says astronomy leads us to a unique event, a universe which was created out of nothing, one with a very delicate balance needed to provide exactly the right conditions required to permit life, and one which has an underlying, one might say, supernatural plan. So that physics itself, looking at the constants and the very, very specified numbers they had to have, comes to that kind of conclusion. And incidentally, the Bible gets very easily dismissed, I'm afraid, also in the God delusion. Penzias added, the best data we have concerning the Big Bang are exactly what I would have predicted had I nothing to go on but the five books of Moses, the Psalms, and the Bible as a whole. It's interesting, ladies and gentlemen, isn't it, that we only got the idea that the universe had a beginning, evidence for it in the 1960s. It was very exciting. I remember it well. Because for centuries, Europe was dominated by the thinking of Aristotle, which put the Earth fixed at the center of the universe, everything rotating about it and everything existing eternally. The fascinating thing is this, that when evidence began to arrive that there was a finite beginning to space-time, some leading people in the journal Nature, the editor, Maddox, said, this is dangerous. We don't like this because it'll give too much leverage to those who believe in creation. Now, what I find very interesting is this. The Bible is frequently dismissed as being anti-scientific because it makes no predictions. Oh, no, that's incorrect. It makes a brilliant prediction. For centuries, it's been saying there was a beginning. And if scientists had taken that a bit more seriously, they might have discovered evidence for the beginning a lot earlier than they did.
You're listening to a live broadcast of the God Delusion Debate from Birmingham, Alabama.
I understand your desire, in some ways, to respond to Dr. Lennox, but I think that this next topic and the excerpt I'm going to read will allow you to both advance the discussion of the next thesis, which is that design is dead. Otherwise, one must explain who designed the designer. I think it'll allow you to advance that well. The quote that I'm going to read, the excerpt, is on page 109. And what you wrote is this. The whole argument turns on the familiar question, who made God, which most thinking people discover for themselves. A designer God cannot be used to explain organized complexity, because any God capable of designing anything would have to be complex enough to demand the same kind of explanation in his own right. God presents an infinite regress from which he cannot help us to escape. This argument, as I shall show in the next chapter, demonstrates that God, though not technically disprovable, is very, very improbable indeed.
First, I find it deeply unimpressive that the Bible, it can be said to predict the Big Bang. There are only two possibilities. Either the universe began or it's been here forever. Just two possibilities. To get one of them is really not that impressive. Now, sorry?
At least it got it right.
Toss a penny, you've got a chance of getting it right 50% of the time. Right. Design is dead, otherwise one must explain who designed the designer. Well, we skate over a lot when we say design is dead. I think probably John and I would agree that life is explained. Darwin explains life, and no serious scientist doubts that. So we go back to the previous, a rather more difficult stage in the understanding of where we come from, which is the origin of the universe itself. And that really is genuinely difficult. We don't know. We understand essentially biology. We don't understand cosmology. In a sense, we could say cosmology is waiting for its Darwin. John mentioned in the answer to the previous question the idea of the physical constants being finely tuned. And it's quite true that many scientists, many physicists maintain that the physical constants, the half dozen or so numbers that physicists have to simply assume in order to derive the rest of their understanding, just have to be assumed. You can't provide a rationale for why those numbers are there. And physicists have calculated that if any of these numbers was a little bit different, the universe as we know it wouldn't exist. We wouldn't be here. The universe would perhaps have fizzled out in the first yoctosecond, and so we wouldn't be here, or other things would have gone wrong. It's tempting, once again, to import the easy, facile idea of a designer and to say that the designer twiddled the knobs of the universe at the Big Bang and got them exactly right, got the gravitational constant right, got the strong force right, the weak force right, and so on. But it seems to me to be manifestly obvious that that is a futile kind of explanation, because, as the quotation says, who designed the designer? You have explained precisely nothing, because instead of just saying, oh, well, the knobs were tuned to the right values anyway, you say, oh, there was a God who knew how to tune the knobs to the right values. And if you're going to postulate that, then you've, in a sense, sold the pass. Some physicists solve that problem by not invoking God, of course, but by invoking the anthropic principle, saying, well, here we are, we exist, we have to be in the kind of universe in which is capable of giving rise to us. That in itself, I think, is unsatisfying, and as John Lennox rightly says, some physicists solve that by the multiverse idea, the idea that our universe is just one of many universes. There's a sort of foaming bubble, a bubbling foam of universes, and the bubble in which we are is only one of billions of universes. And each of these universes has different fundamental constants. Most of them have fundamental constants which are unsuited to give rise to the sort of permanence and the sort of chemistry, the sort of conditions that gives biological evolution, Darwinian evolution, the chance to get going. A tiny minority of those universes has what it takes to give rise to Darwinian evolution, ultimately chemistry and then evolution, and that tiny minority has to include the universe in which we sit, because here we are. The anthropic principle, the principle that we have to be in a universe capable of giving rise to us, plus the principle of the multiverse, provides at least an interim, satisfying explanation in a way that a creator couldn't possibly be a satisfying explanation for the reason that I've given. Then, having got ourselves into a universe which is capable of generating stars, capable of generating chemistry, and ultimately capable of generating the origin of life, then biological evolution takes over, and now we're on a clear run. Now we understand what happened. Once biological evolution gets going, then it's easy to understand most of what's difficult. Most of the difficulty of understanding the universe lies in the vast complexity of life. That's what really truly impresses people. That's why people who believe in God mostly do believe in God, because they look around the living world and they see how impressive it is. So that level of impressiveness is completely destroyed by Darwin, and Darwin, of course, doesn't explain the origin of the universe. For that, I invoke the anthropic principle and the multiverse. Less satisfying, admittedly, but science makes progress. The one thing you can be absolutely sure is that a creative designer cannot be a satisfying explanation.
Dr. Lennox.
The anthropic principle, as you stated, Richard, I think is a complete truism. Of course we have to be on such and such a kind of planet of the kind that we could appear on. That does not answer the question how we came to exist on it. And I fear I have to disagree with your Darwinism. Darwinism does not explain life. It may explain certain things about what happens when you've got life. But evolution assumes the existence of a mutating replicator. It does not explain how that replicator came to exist in the first place. Now, that's a major discussion. I want to address the who designed the designer question, because it's the old schoolboy question, who created God. I'm actually very surprised to find it as a central argument in your book, because it assumes that God is created. And I'm not surprised, therefore, that you call the book The God Delusion, because created gods are, by definition, a delusion. Now, I know, and I ought to explain, that Richard doesn't like people who say to him that they don't believe in the God he doesn't believe in. But I think that this is possibly touching a sore spot, because you leave yourself wide open to the charge. After all, you are arguing that God is a delusion. And in order to weigh your argument, I said that it is you who's arguing that God is a delusion.
Oh, sorry. All right.
And in order to weigh that argument, I need to know what you mean by God. And if you say, if there is a God, you have to ask who created God, that means that you're reduced to thinking about created gods. Well, none of us believe in created gods, Jews, Muslims, or Christians. And I think that argument then is entirely beside the point, and perhaps you ought to put it on your shelf marked celestial teapots where it belongs. The God who created the universe, ladies and gentlemen, was not created. He is eternal. This is the fundamental distinction between God and the universe. It came to exist, he did not. And this is precisely the point the Christian apostle John makes at the beginning of his gospel. In the beginning was the Word. The Word already was. All things came to be by him. God is uncreated. The universe was created by him. Now, I don't know whether Richard has difficulty with the concept of the uncreated. I don't know, and I'd love to know whether he believes as a materialist that matter and energy and the laws of nature were always there, because if they were, he does believe in something eternal. So perhaps the difficulty lies in believing in an eternal person. But I want to probe deeper into this, because he suggested that introducing God would mean an end of science. God is no explanation, since by definition God is more complex than the thing you are explaining. Now, this, he states, is the central argument of his book. I would not have expected an argument like this from a scientist, because explanations in science themselves are usually in terms of increasing complexity. An apple falling is a simple event. The explanation in terms of Newton's law of gravitation is already stretching the minds of many people, but its explanation in terms of a warp in space-time is stretching the minds of the cleverest. Simplicity isn't the only criterion of truth. Let me give you an example. Suppose you're an archaeologist, and I'm exploring a cave with you, and you're a Chinese expert, and on this cave you see two scratches. And you say, human intelligence. And I say, pardon, they're just two scratches. And you say, but those are the Chinese character run, which means a human being. But I say, look, Richard, that's no explanation at all. You're postulating something as complex as a human brain to explain two scratches. That means that your explanation is more complex than the thing you're explaining. That's no explanation at all. Now, it seems to me that's exactly what you're saying in your book. The reason we can deduce something as sophisticated as human intelligence from two scratches on a cave wall is because they have a semiotic dimension. They carry meaning. And that fascinates me as a mathematician, because the reductionist is committed to deducing things that carry meaning, and I would include the DNA molecule among them, is committed to explaining those in terms of the basic materials. But as was pointed out a long time ago by a Nobel Prize winner, Roger Sperry, the meaning of the message is not going to be found in the physics and chemistry of the paper and ink. And it fascinated me, too, to see that you approved in your book of the physicists looking for a TOE, a theory of everything. But that's a theory where the buck stops. Incidentally, there is no hope for a TOE, as Stephen Hawking has said in 2004 on the basis of Gödel's mathematics and its application to physicists. So I'm interested that you were prepared, as I understand it, to agree that a TOE was a good thing in physics. It's perhaps you like a TOE, a toe, provided there's no God attached to it.
Well, I hope you've enjoyed the first half of the God Delusion debate. We'll air the second part of this debate next week on Raw Talk. So be sure to come back and join us next Sunday at 7 p.m. for the second half of the God Delusion debate. Until next Sunday, this is Yo thanking you for joining us for this special presentation of Raw Talk, and I hope you have a very Merry Christmas.